Good morning, I'm Dr. Elliot Malamud. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy calls Yeshaya Leibowitz one of the most outspoken and controversial Jewish thinkers and Israeli public intellectuals of the 20th century. He was once termed the conscience of Israel by his childhood contemporary from Riga, Isaiah Berlin. Leibowitz's thought is founded on his continuous argument about divine transcendence. It is this philosophical commitment that also yielded some striking political positions, including, of course, his early and highly controversial stance regarding Israeli policy towards the territories captured during the Six-Day War. Yeshaya Leibowitz was born in Riga in 1903, and along with his education at the gymnasium, he was concurrently homeschooled for his Jewish studies before the family fled Russia in 1919 for Berlin. At the University of Berlin, Leibowitz studied chemistry and philosophy, received his doctorate in chemistry in 1924, and in 1935 he moved to Palestine, initially as a professor of biochemistry at Hebrew U, and he was later appointed as head of biological and organic chemistry and professor of neurophysiology at the medical school. He also lectured in the history of science. But of course, we know in addition that Leibowitz taught Jewish thought, whether it was in an academic context, in small study groups, on television and radio, and he was well known on the Israeli public scene, whether in his criticisms of the religious parties — he once compared religious parties in Israel to a kept mistress — or his argument as early as 1968 that Israel should withdraw from the newly conquered West Bank and Gaza Strip, or his public call for conscientious objectors from the time of the Lebanon War of 1982, and consequently in the Palestinian territories. In the year before he died, he reiterated his call on soldiers to refuse to serve in the territories, using, not for the first time, highly provocative language comparing special units of the Israeli army to the SS. The speech followed the announcement that he was to receive the Israel Prize, the country's most prestigious civilian award, in recognition of his life's work, and it was a move that precipitated an appeal to the Supreme Court and a threat to boycott the ceremony by Prime Minister Rabin. Leibowitz, however, saved everyone further embarrassment by declining the award. His philosophy found expression in numerous essays that first appeared in Hebrew periodicals and were subsequently collated into a number of volumes. He's actually better known in Israel than in the English-speaking world, but the publication in English of a collection of his writings in 1992 entitled Judaism, Human Values, and the Jewish State opened up his work to a certain extent to new avenues of engagement. So it's really an honor today to introduce Professor Asa Kosher to discuss Leibowitz's work. Professor Kosher is the winner himself of the 2000 Israel Prize in Philosophy. He's a world-renowned expert in the fields of linguistics, pragmatics, and epistemology, and he's one of Israel's leading intellectuals. He's the author of numerous scholarly and popular writings on political theory and Israeli democracy. He regularly serves an advisory role to various governmental bodies and institutions, and as we pointed out last night, he's the co-author of the IDF Code of Ethics. He's the Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at Tel Aviv University. Professor Kosher has taught at Oxford, UCLA, the IDF College of Command and General Staff, and other institutions in Israel and abroad. Please welcome Asa Kosher. Professor Kosher, why don't we start briefly by giving an outline of basically Professor Leibowitz's project, so to speak, especially his project about Jewish identity.
I'd like to draw a distinction between Leibowitz, the person interested in Jewish thought and philosophy, and Leibowitz, who is interested in current politics. I mean, there are ties between the two faces of Leibowitz, but they are weaker than people think. So let me just put aside his provocative pronouncements concerning many issues, and let's look at the deepest layer of Jewish thought. Leibowitz had a project. Generally speaking, it's on a par with Maimonides' project in Moreh Nevuchim, not in the other writings. In Moreh Nevuchim, the idea, the guide to the perplexed, the idea is to portray Judaism in a way that on the one hand is within the framework of tradition. On the other hand, it's compatible with Aristotelian philosophy. It should be responsible. It should be philosophically decent. That was Maimonides' project. And Leibovitz thought about a similar project. Okay, let's look at Judaism. Let's look at the Jewish tradition, the Jewish people. And let's describe them in a responsible way. Not only responsible, I mean, in as a matter of fact, those are the facts about the Jewish people, but let it be philosophically decent. And for Leibovitz, philosophical was more Kantian than anything else, even though he didn't say it too many times. But my wife wrote a book on Leibovitz. I wrote many papers. My wife wrote a book. And she was the first to show that there is a Kantian framework. Okay. Now, the major ideas in his project were the following, very briefly put. First of all, if you look at what is common to Jews before Enlightenment, Jews since the destruction of the temple, since the Mishnah and Talmud and Gemara, to the days of the Enlightenment, what is common to them is the commitment to worship God according to Allah. This is what is common to everybody. They don't share their philosophy, they don't share their conceptions of divinity, they don't share a lot of other views concerning any aspects of science or history or whatever. They share the commitment to worship God according to Allah. This is one major ingredient of his view. Secondly, he draws a distinction between the religion. He wants to render the religion independent of everything else. So he draws a distinction between religion, and I speak Jewish religion all the time. He draws a distinction between the religion and science on the one hand, and religion and morality on the other hand. Religion and science have nothing to do with each other, according to Leibovitz, because science is interested in the facts, and religion is interested in the norms, in what science is interested in what is the case. Religion is interested in what ought to be the case, ought to be your behavior, namely worshiping God according to halakha. So there is a distinction between the two of them. Nothing that scientists could tell us will change anything in our religion, because our religion says, okay, you pray this way, you eat this way, you conduct your behavior in other areas of your life according to halakha, and meaning it as a worship of God, and let science do science. I mean, that's perfectly all right. Now, morality. For Leibovitz, morality was Kantian morality, which means putting the attributes of human beings at the center, rationality, wisdom, being able to draw conclusions in a logical way. So putting the person, the human person, at the center of the whole worldview. Now, for Leibovitz, there was a strong opposition. The religion puts God at the center of its worldview and its the human conduct, whereas morality puts something else, puts the person, the human person, there at the center. So they're different. They're incompatible with each other. Now, this doesn't mean that he was immoral in the intuitive daily sense. I mean, he was whenever there is no halacha concerning a certain issue, then what he did was preach morality, but not morality as putting the person at the center of the worldview, but acting decently, acting in a humane way. I mean, acting as we call what we call moral behavior. Finally, there is a third ingredient that I should mention, and you used it for the title of this conversation. There is a very strong distinction between for the sake of heaven and for the sake of something else, and it is an insight into the nature of Jewish tradition, including halakha. Okay, he puts it very beautifully. If you look at Kriyat Shema, okay, Kriyat Shema consists of three different sections. The first section is worshiping God for the sake of heaven, for the sake of God. I mean, you're not promised anything, you're not threatened by any type of punishment. It's for the sake of heaven. Then, thank you very much. Then the second section is completely different. I mean, if you worship God properly, then there's going to be esev le'esev besadcha livhemtecha. Okay, which means okay, your cows will have plenty of food in the fields. Okay, you worship God in order to serve the food of your cows. Okay, what's going on? But that's doing something not for the sake of heaven, but in a way that is compatible with the religious prescriptions. Which means that he put it in this way that the Jewish halacha and tradition is sensitive to human weakness, which means, okay, we are human beings, we are weak, we have all kinds of weaknesses, everyone with his or her own weaknesses. So the religion, unlike Christianity, for example, where there are nuns and monks who are sequestered from daily life, they don't have family, they don't have children, they are just, you know, devoted to worship of their divinity. No, our way is different. Our way is that we are ordinary human beings with our merits and demerits, with our weaknesses and with our strengths. And okay, if you worship God because you think that your cows will have food in the field, fine, because you worship God. And because you mean it to worship God, you don't mean to worship your cows as in India, you don't mean to worship some other divinity. You don't mean anything but worship of God, but you do it in a weaker sense. The ideal is to do it for the sake of heaven, and this is what he preached. I mean, if you want to see one motive that appears in his many books and conversations, by the way, he has never written a book. He always gave lectures and then wrote them down as papers, and published the papers, and collected them. And both my wife and I asked him repeatedly, I mean, why didn't you put your system into a book form in order for everyone to understand your system from the beginning to the end? And his answer was that, well, that would be a futile attempt to put forward a worldview. Nobody can put forward a worldview. I think he was mistaken on that. But anyway, I mean, there is much to read. I mean, the whole shelf of books and papers and conversations. And this is the major theme running through them. There is a distinction between for the sake of heaven and for any other purpose. He wrote a little booklet. I don't know whether it exists in English. About five persons. It's called For the Sake of Heaven. And it describes five books. Two from the Bible, Bereshit and Kohelet, and then Maimonides and Chovat HaLevavot and Mesilat Yesharim. And he shows that in each of them, I mean, the major issue is Lishma versus Lo Lishma. For the sake of heaven, for the sake of something.
So let's just summarize here some of the fundamental concepts. So the first thing is that Leibowitz felt the common denominator for Jews was commitment to halacha.
To worship God
through the halacha, right, and not anything else. Right. He has a bit of a paradoxical relationship between worshiping God and yet having human morality, Kantian morality. But the key concept seems to be that there are two levels of how you can worship God. One of them for the sake of God only, with no other kind of ulterior motives, not reward, not fear of punishment, nothing. And then there's a kind of concession, I guess we could say, to the fact that human beings have weakness, that they will worship God for self-interest or fear of punishment, and that these are reflected in the sequence of the first two paragraphs of Kriyat Shema. But something that is underpinning all of that, and what I want to talk about with now, is this idea that's just very puzzling to me in all these years I've been reading him, which is this radical transcendence of God, which I assume he gets from Maimonides, that God is absolutely incomparable to any other form of reality. But he seems to take it almost further. In other words, if God, in Leibowitz, God is separate from everything. He's separate from nature. He's separate from history. So is there any meaningful sense, first of all, let's begin here, for Leibowitz, that you can talk about God at all?
You cannot talk about God. You can talk about worshiping God.
And so in other words, you can talk about the human act,
right,
only.
Right. Worshiping God means acting according to halacha. This is the meaning of of your activity. You cannot talk directly about God. Now he was very much in the Maimonides, in the footsteps of Maimonides. Let me mention that the idea of concession is also from Maimonides. If you remember that in the Guide to the Perplexed, in the third part, Maimonides explains all the mitzvot, all the commandments. So he tries to explain the resort to sacrificing. Why? Sacrificing animals. I mean, why should we sacrifice animals when the temple exists? And Maimonides' answer is that this is concession to human weakness. I mean, here is a people, they're coming, they just came out of Egypt. Every religion in the area they are familiar with has some form of ritual that involves sacrifices. So how can you tell them, now this is your religion, but without any sacrifice? They won't accept it, because religion comes with sacrifices. And his analogy is very interesting. Maimonides' analogy. Assume that we try to establish, that one has tried to establish, presently establish a new religion without prayer. I mean, would anybody accept it? Could there be a religion without prayer? Everyone would say, no, impossible, right? At that time, without sacrifice, it was impossible. I mean, inconceivable. But which means that you really don't need sacrifices. And forgive me for saying it. I mean, what Maimonides hints is that actually, even prayers, I mean, we could have managed without prayers. But halacha is that prayers are there, and so we worship God according to halacha, so there is prayer, and prayer has the structure of sacrificing, right? Shachrit, musaf, and things like this, and therefore, even the word musaf comes from the sphere of sacrificing. So this is Maimonides' concession. Now, concerning attempts to depict God. Now, there are two different reasons here. One is on a factual level. I mean, look at what people in the history of Jewish thought said about God. You look at, I don't know, look at Maimonides, look at Yehuda Levi, look at Chasdai Kreskas, look at Kabbalists, look at anybody. Now, what you find is a whole spectrum of different models of divinity. Together with an American philosopher of religion, last year I edited and published a book called The Models of God. And it includes 80 papers, each of which is a description of a certain concept of divinity in some religion or culture. It includes several papers on Judaism, but many on other denominations. So there are innumerously many different conceptions of divinity. Now, what is the Jewish conception of divinity? The answer is, there is none. There is none. If I enter a synagogue, people don't ask me what is my conception of divinity. They ask me whether I need a siddur. They tell me where the kippah is, right? They don't ask me for my conception of divinity. Which, because the idea is the common denominator of Jews in the tradition, okay, worship God, whatever your conception is, according to halach. This is, as a matter of fact. But there is something deeper. Assume I have a certain model of divinity. Take the standard, the so-called, the God of philosophers. The God of philosophers is omniscient, omnipotent, and perfectly good. Now, take the idea of being perfectly strong. Okay? You are approaching the danger of indulging in idolatry. The stronger I am, the closer I am to God. Okay, infinitely different. But the stronger, the better, right? The better, the better. The knowing more, the better. So you take some human attributes, you take attributes of human beings, and you put them into your conception of divinity, which renders them very important. And now you take certain aspects of the world and render them very important. That's idolatry. Idolatry means that you take something from the world and you give it a major role to play in your life. So speaking about strength, about wisdom, about being good is, I mean, I don't, there are numerous problems, the so-called the problem of evil, numerous problems concerning this model, but I'm not interested in them. I'm interested in just the danger of idolatry. So models that people have concerning divinity are constantly bringing the person closer to idolatry. And this is the major thrust of Jewish tradition. Get away from idolatry. Get away from any danger of idolatry. Get away from any slippery slope toward idolatry. Fighting idolatry is at the essence.
Let's just stay on this point for 1 second. Okay, so both for Maimonides and Leibowitz, there's a project to avoid idolatrous conceptions of God, which means any anthropomorphizing, any descriptions of God in a certain way. Here's the problem. Here's the problem with Maimonides in the Guide, and here's the problem with Leibowitz. You have a tension, really, and actually Kenneth Zieskind put this very well, between uniqueness and intelligibility. In other words, the more you purify this conception of God and you say God is not like anything human, God cannot be described, God cannot be anthropomorphized, you shouldn't have a conception of God, so you maintain this philosophical purity, but there's almost no God left there in terms of, say, popular religion to connect to. Also, Scripture itself seems to throw a monkey wrench into the proceedings by talking about all sorts of notions of reward and punishment, and why would anyone come and pray if they felt there was no God there to pray to? It was just a black box. This tension between uniqueness and intelligibility, Leibowitz never seemed bothered by it, but I certainly am.
Okay. First of all, praying to God doesn't mean, according to Leibowitz's views or Maimonides' view, doesn't mean praying to something that does not exist there. I mean, the question of existence of God does not exist within the tradition. If you look at Bereshit, okay, we are reading Bereshit portion. I mean, nobody there has a proof for the existence of God. Nobody there doubts the existence of God. Even the Gentiles that play a role until Pharaoh in Egypt. And then there is the fight over the Makot. So there is no existence there, no proof for existence. There is an assumption of existence. But the assumption is of existence of a God, and you are not under any commitment to describe it. You're unable indeed to understand it. You just have your conception and you do whatever is required by the Jewish method of worshiping God to do.
But isn't there a lot of psychic pressure on the worshiper? Now, as you're telling the worshiper, do what the halakha tells you to do in tefillah and everything else in mitzvot, but with no notion of how any of this operates or works.
No, I'm not telling you not to have any notion. I'm telling you that I don't have any ordinary notion, and I'm telling you that I'm not interested in your notion. I mean, whatever your notion of divinity is, as long as it is not something which is conspicuously idolatry, then, okay, let it be your notion. It could be Maimonides' notion, it could be Yehuda Levi's notion, whatever. Hasidic notion, Kabbalic notion. Have your notion. But then you have your notion, worship God according to that notion in the halachic way. By the way, I don't think he said it, but I think it can be said on his behalf. Look at Shema Yisrael. Why is it so important? Shema Yisrael, Shem Elokeinu, Shem Echad. Why is it such a central saying within the Jewish tradition? Okay, she has her own conception, and she has her own conception, and he has his own conception. Now, what guarantees the identification of those notions? Okay, within the synagogue, there are 100 notions of divinity. Perhaps there are 100 divinities. And Shema Yisrael comes to say, no, we behave on the firm grounds of the assumption that whatever your notion is, it's the same. It's the same divinity. So we all worship the same God, about which, from my point of view, we can say nothing. Not about the Bible. The Bible looks like first stories and then commandments and then there are proverbs and then there are prophecies and you have all the different genres possible at a time in the Bible. So it is that there is danger of being misled by the genres to think that, okay, so there is some science there and some predictions there and things like this. But the idea, according to Leibovich's view, is that it's all normative. It's all normative. It doesn't, we're not, if you're interested in the facts, talk to the scientists. If you're interested in the norms of Judaism, then, okay, look at the halakha. And halakha somehow brings you back to the Bible, and in particular to the Torah. So it's an education. It's an educational text concerning the norms. But so it's not meant. Right. Just a second. It's not meant for the philosopher with the abstract notions. It is meant for kids, for every ordinary person. Okay, we'd like to give you an impression of what the norms are. And we do it in a way which everyone can understand and everyone can identify oneself with, and we are not interested in scientific stories or in predictions. Leibovich points out a beautiful expression in the Tosfot somewhere, where the Baalei HaTosafot, where the authors of the Tosfot say, the prophet is not one who predicts the future. The prophet says what ought to be the future. Which means if people behave properly, then that would be the future. Or sometimes it ought to be the future, sometimes it ought to have been the future. But it's not prediction. It's not on the realm of facts, it's on the realm of norms.
Well, I'm trying to get to what in other domains would be called a shell game, okay? So you have this idea, you're making an argument, Leibovitz's argument is that there's this thing called normative Judaism. We don't worry about God, we worry about how to behave, right? But at some point, what's the ontological connection? In other words, if you say there's a God as a proposition, but then you remove that God from history, which means you remove that God from revelation also, right? So it's almost like you have these two separate realities. God's this black box. Then there's Judaism. Judaism is a set of norms. Don't worry about God. Do this thing. But how can you tell Jews to do this thing when you've completely removed it from some sort of ontological grounding? And you're still asking them, that's why I said there's psychic pressure. You're asking them to do all this stuff, but you're telling them you're never going to know in any way any line that draws an ontological thread between the thing you're doing and God, forget about describing God, the very notion that God is involved in anything historical, including the giving of the Torah. So I don't understand how, there's something almost schizophrenic here. Like, how does Leibovitz maintain the idea that we should be all doing this stuff when on the other hand, there's no there. There's no ground underneath it. It's just like what Jews do. Why should we do what Jews do? Because that's what Jews do. That's circular.
It's not circular. It's not circular. I mean, if you want to be a part of a certain tradition, then you have decided to be part of a certain tradition. There's no circularity there. There is a decision there to be a member of a certain tradition. And what Leibovich says about Jews, I mean, what Leibovich says about Jews joining the tradition, chozrim b'tshuva, that they just have made a decision to act within the tradition. No, whatever their conception of divinity, it doesn't matter. What does matter is whether they are in the tradition or not. Now, I must stress it again and again. I mean, activities are not meant for your own sake. Activities are not in order to be smart, in order to be rich, in order to be successful. I mean, all the prayers for a better life are emblems of weaknesses. Okay, Leibovitz said that, you pray as if God is your minister of defense, minister of health, minister of agriculture. I mean, if you have problems in ministry of agriculture, there is a minister of agriculture there. Why do you bother God with your problems of agriculture? And there is the meaning of what you do. And the meaning of what you do is that it's worshiping God. And you are in a tradition where the activities of a person have the meaning of worshiping God. Now, for different people, the meaning of worshiping God has a common denominator, namely worshiping the divinity, and differences, because worshiping God according to one model, according to another model is somewhat different, although we all assume that this is the same divinity. So, I mean, philosophy is a discipline that educated us to look into proofs, for the existence or proofs for the non-existence and things like this. But within a certain tradition, you make certain assumptions, you accept them, and you act on them, and you don't indulge yourself in trying to prove those assumptions. They are your very assumptions. Sometimes
I can see this is going to be difficult. Let's try this again. All right. There's a mythos that religion rests on, right? All religions rest on a mythos that would be the incentive to do the thing, right? If you say to me, why, for a basic statement, God commands me to put on tefillin. Now, the way I'm understanding your interpretation or your presentation of Leibovitz, all that statement means is, I've joined a tradition that says put on tefillin, and I do it. So that's a closed circle. In other words, there's nothing religious about it. It's a tribal sort of norm where I go where the Jewish tribe is, and I do what they do, right? So in the ordinary conception of the worshiper, religion is about the impetus to do these things, because ultimately there's some ontological connection to something metaphysical. Without that connection, I'm just practicing some sort of sociology. This is what we do in this place. We read these words. Why are we reading these words? Why are we doing any of these things? Because this is what Jews say we do?
You keep ignoring the meaning of what you do. I mean, you keep talking about as if what Leibovitz tells you is just do, which is important. I mean, important. To do is important. That's the common denominator. But there is a meaning to it, and the meaning to it is worshiping God. So when you join a tradition, or when you are in the tradition, you are in a tradition of acting in a certain way, the meaning of which is worshiping God.
How do I know that's worshiping God? Who told me?
I mean, that's a
if you say the halakha told me.
That is, again, either a school question or a philosophical question.
But who's the author of the halakha?
Who told me? I don't have to be told by anybody. I mean, this is the meaning I give to my activity. It's not, I mean, you mentioned earlier the conception of divine commands, as if we pray in a certain way because God commanded us to pray this way. No way, according to Leibovitz. I mean, divine commands are, again, a conception that people can toy with, not committing him and not committing anybody. I mean, if you look at halakha, I mean, you're right. I don't know how many.
No, I'm not arguing that the details of halakha necessarily are divine.
Wait.
But is the conception of why I would do it somehow divine?
No.
Uh-huh.
No,
okay.
You worship God. You do not obey His commands. You're worshiping. You worship Him. Those are two different relationships. So if you think about it, I mean, and if you want to think in terms of divine command, be my guest. I mean, because there are different models and different ways of portraying the meaning, then do it. But what he says, what he is interested in, is the common denominator on the one hand and his own conception on the other hand. So if you look at the halakha, then, now the Daf HaYomi is Yevamot. Okay, is it I mean, the way they make decisions concerning, okay, there are five brothers, four sisters who married them, and one has died, and then he said to the other one, to one of the women, okay, I'm going to marry you, but she died. I mean, if you look at all those circumstances, and how halacha is made about those circumstances by interpreting a certain word that appears twice in a certain verse, okay? So that's the idea. Okay, was that divine? I mean, is that divine command to interpret those two words that appear in the same, a word that appears twice in the same verse, as telling us that the fifth sister should not marry the fourth brother, and things like this? I mean, it's not. Chazal created the halachic interpretation of the Bible. Actually, Chazal created the sanctity of the Bible. That's not disputable, because in the Talmud we have the arguments whether a certain verse or a certain book should be part of the Bible or not. Okay, should Kohelet be part of the Bible or not? Should Job be part of the Bible or not? Job, there are 10 different explanations of who, stories about who was Job, and one of them said Job did not exist at all. It's just, you know, mashal haya. It is just a story. But it's a story with religious significance. So Chazal decided that those are the holy reed, those books are the holy reed, and they should be taken to form the foundation of the religion. And the foundation means that the values expressed there are the values of the religion, and the values are worshiping God, getting rid of all forms of idolatry. But the way you do it, the halachic way of doing it, I mean, Chazal has made a lot of decisions concerning it. Just look at Yevamot. Okay, what comes first, Yibum or Chalitza? Okay, in the Torah, Yibum comes first, and then Chalitza. Even yesterday we read about it, right, with Tamar and the three brothers. So Yibum comes before Chalitza. If you read, if you study the halacha in Masechet Yevamot or present day halacha, I mean, Chalitza comes before Yibum. So even if the Torah said something, that doesn't mean that the halacha will not say something of the opposite nature. So there is an interesting relationship. That was the first paper I wrote about Leibovitz. Interesting relationship between halacha and Torah and Kitvei HaKodesh. Leibovitz thought that this is paradoxical, and he loved paradoxes, and I showed that it's not a paradox at all. I mean, okay, the Chazal established the identity of the books in our holy read, and by making that decision, they made the decision that those books are the foundations. So there is a decision to hold them as the foundations. Foundations in terms of pure expression of the values. It doesn't do anything more than purely manifest the values of the religion.
I understand all that. You haven't answered my question. I'm not saying, it's clear to anybody who studied it that Chazal, this is an enormous creation of details, values, structures, and norms. All I wanted was one ontological thread between the religion that was practiced historically and some sort of divine impetus. Because if there is no such thread at all, then it is a tribe that does its own thing. It may feel wonderful doing it, it may feel holy doing it, it may feel historical doing it, but it's a circle. If you tell me that God gave the Torah, and in that Torah it tells us that this is what we should do for God, but you remove God from history, so you're basically saying that there's a humanly constructed religion, and we should follow that because that's what these humans decided we should be doing in terms of being Jewish.
First of all, I'm not afraid about the Jewish tradition be a tribal tradition. Okay, we are a tribe with open gates through which people go both ways, out and in. But that's a tradition of our tribe. But the tradition of our tribe is worshiping God. I mean, you keep ignoring it. It's worshiping God. I mean, there is no proof of the existence of God in the Talmud. Okay? There is no proof there. I mean, it's an assumption made. If you don't accept the assumption, be my guest. I don't know, worship yourself. I mean, or whatever. I mean, if you don't take... I don't have anything to say. This is an insight of Leibovich. And he said it numerous times. I don't have anything to sell to the person who says there is no God. Okay, there is no God. I don't know what you're talking about. There is no God. Leave me alone. So he constantly said that he doesn't have anything to tell such a person. If you don't make this assumption, if you don't have this idea of worshiping God, then you don't have. He even, I remember once I visited him with my wife and he said, oh, before you there was a woman here who told me that she had a kid who suffered from some sickness. She prayed to God and said, if the child is cured, then I'll start being religious. And so she prayed, and the doctors were very effective in curing the child, and the child is healthy, and now she said, there was something, a spiritual revolution in myself. Mifne nafshi. And he said, I don't have a clue as to what she means by it. What does she mean? What actually does she mean? What is a mifne nafshi because of which she became religious? Okay, you either make the assumption, or not. If you are in the religion, you are viewed as one who has made this assumption. Now, a small concession. Some people may be active in the tradition for social reasons. Okay, actually, all of the kids are in that position. The kids who grow within houses of religious families, I mean, at the beginning, they've not made any decision. They just follow in the footsteps of their mothers and fathers. So they are socially members of those traditions. But then there comes a minute when, I don't know if it's bar mitzvah or some later point during their being teenagers, that they have to make a decision. Now, actually, they don't have to make a decision, right? Because that's the second section of Kriyat Shema. They can, you know, think about all kinds of stories of being worried about food for the cows. And okay. But that's not the ideal. And you can understand it. I mean, even if it's not the matter of looking at Judaism, looking at anything, there are different, even concerning moral attitude. I mean, the Kantian attitude towards morality. I respect human beings not because it's beneficial, not because it's an easier way of life, not because it would give you so all kinds of rewards, because that's morality. I mean, be moral because that's morality. Because morality means respecting human dignity. Why should I respect human dignity? Because it's human dignity. Okay? It's a basic assumption. And it's a basic assumption to look at something as the major ingredient of the ideal position. It's not because it gives you something. Generally speaking, if you want proofs, if you want arguments, then proofs and arguments rest on assumptions. Okay? There is some assumption under my proof. Assume the consequence is that there is something. But what are the assumptions? Okay, and when you make assumptions and you reach conclusions, one, that's just the first step in the game. Now let's ask questions about your assumptions. So prove your assumption. Okay, I'll prove you my assumption. Then you go even an additional step backwards, and you prove these assumptions. But you prove this assumption on grounds of other assumptions. So that's infinite regress. I mean, you ought to stop somewhere. You ought to stop at the very beginning at what gives you the perspective. And and halacha as worshiping God is the basic assumption.
Let's move a little bit forward. I wanted to refine a little bit this idea of lishma and lo lishma. There was a sort of interesting, you're probably aware there was this interesting sort of dialogue for many years between David Hartman and Yeshaya Leibowitz about Lishman Lo Lishman. In one of his essays, Hartman really criticizes Leibowitz. In an interesting way, he says that Leibowitz's system kind of equates all motivations together. So for Leibowitz, if I help the little old lady across the street because I want to help her in a time of distress, or I do so because I want to seem impressive to other people, those are both formally lo lishma. In other words, I did it for a beautiful reason, I did it for a self-interested reason, but both of those are lo lishma for Leibowitz. So Hartman accuses Leibowitz of making the reasons performing these mitzvot like absurdly equivalent, because commonsensically we would say that helping the lady across the street because I want to help her is of a higher value than helping her across the street because I want to seem like a great guy. But for Leibowitz, those are both lo lishma. So how would you respond to that?
I don't know where Hartman took it from. There is indeed a difference between, first of all, okay, there are all kinds of activities that are not for the sake of heaven. Okay, that's agreed. But within those activities, there are different types. And the major classification is according to how close it brings you to some kind of idolatry. So there are things that are, you can perform quite naturally without indulging in any idolatry, but there are things that are dangerous. So the things you do, not for the sake of heaven, but for the sake of something else, some of them are dangerous. For example, Leibowitz was very much in opposition to giving an imminent religious significance to the state of Israel. He was a Zionist, an active Zionist, and all of his children are Zionists, and grandchildren. Zionism is the name of the attitude, of the political attitude there, ideological attitude. But the state is just an instrument for ordering the common way of life of different citizens. It's not of imminent religious significance. So if you do something for the sake of the state, that's dangerous. Sometimes it's okay. It's not. It can be sanctioned. But be careful. There is a slope there.
So you're arguing that his lo lishma had different levels of lo lishma.
Of course.
And that Hartman's equation of it is too dichotomous.
Yeah, right.
That Leibowitz valued certain kinds of lo lishma above other kinds of lo lishma.
Right. Okay. According to the danger of idolatry.
Let's stick with the Zionistic theme. Does Leibowitz see Zionism as entailing a kind of halachic revolution? In other words, that halacha has to change the way it operates?
That's an interesting question. But I forgot to mention it earlier. Leibowitz is formerly a recipient of Israel Prize.
Oh, he got it.
He didn't decline it. I was involved in it. I was there were committees giving the Prize of Israel. I was in a committee of philosophy. There was another committee of life projects. And we were coordinated, and he was given the prize. Now, according to Israeli law, Prizes of Israel is a law. It's in the law. According to the law, if a committee makes a recommendation and the minister approves it, then the person has received the Prize of Israel. So we made the recommendation, the ministress at the time approved it, and therefore he is a recipient of the Prize of Israel. The question was whether he would come to the ceremony. Mm-hmm. And some of the assistants of, Prime Minister Rabin couldn't care less about the whole affair. But one of his assistants told him that, how can you shake the hand of Leibowitz, who 2 days ago said that soldiers in the West Bank are like hunting dogs, which is awful. This is awful. I always told Leibowitz what he speaks. He speaks in those provocative terms, thinking that this will provoke the thoughts, this will close the ears of people. Like Disco Kotel and Judeo-Nazi. Those are awful expressions. So, but Rabin couldn't care less. But one of the assistants cared more and convinced Rabin to make an announcement that he won't come to the ceremony. And then Leibowitz said that there are many recipients, many of whom are colleagues at the Hebrew University. So if I come, then Rabin doesn't come, and therefore they will get their prizes without the prime minister. Okay, so why should I, ruin their ceremony? So I'll stay home. And he stayed home. So he is a recipient. Now Leibovitz, one ingredient of Leibovitz's view is that Judaism expresses itself in all spheres of life. Okay, you work 6 days, you work 7 days Shabbat. You eat. Okay, you can eat a lot of things, but not everything. You can marry. You ought even to marry, but not everyone, and things like this. So you are, unlike Christianity, it's the religion of ordinary activities of human beings. Okay. Now, in the diaspora, for many centuries, Jews were not involved in many aspects of human life. They were interested in themselves, in the families, communities, a cluster of communities sometimes, but not in state affairs. They're hardly interested in state affairs. There is a beautiful book by Chafetz Chaim called Machane Israel, The Camp of Israel. The Camp of Israel is the instructions that Chafetz Chaim gave to Jewish soldiers in Russian and Polish armies. So what does the Chafetz Chaim have to tell them? When he writes the book, it's 1881, I think the book was published. What does he have to tell them? Okay, the whole book is about, okay, war is awful, so beware of what's going on in war. But that's just, you know, not halacha, it's morality. What does he have to tell them? Authoritatively, two items. First of all, dina de malchuta dina, which means whatever the king tells you to do in the affairs of the military activity, do. You're not in charge of just war doctrine and just in bello, just as bello. I mean, the king is in charge. The king will tell you to do this and that. Do this and that. Dina de malchuta dina. Secondly, minimize violations of commandments with respect to food and Sabbath, and the Shabbat. Okay. If the king tells you to work in Shabbat, work in Shabbat. But try to minimize it. If they give you a certain work to do, a certain load, if you can complete your duties within 6 days and keep the Shabbat, observe the Shabbat. But that's it. That's it. Now, that's Leibovitz's point, that's an obvious one. Now, since the moment Israel has been there, we are the king. We are the king who ought to tell the soldiers what to do. So it's our duty to have a policy, to have regulations, to have commandments with respect to the way that state affairs should be conducted, in particular war affairs, military affairs. Now, so at the beginning of the early years of the state, Leibovitz preached again, the expression was wrong and misleading, something like a halachic revolution. We need a revolution. I mean, okay, rabbis are afraid of revolutions, right? They have the conservative instinct. I mean, moving this from here to here is already a revolution. Don't move it. Okay, let it. Chadash asur min haTorah kol hazman. I mean, novelties are forbidden. So speaking about revolutions was counterproductive. But what he meant was something very productive and fruitful and important. Okay, we know how to conduct the sphere of work in the Jewish way of life, right? 6 days, seventh day. And preparations for the seventh day, and things like this. So we ought to have a system of commandments concerning how to run a state, how to run a democratic nation state. So he preached it and preached it and preached it, and the rabbis and the religious parties at the time were just interested in, let's have our school, our synagogue, our mikveh, leave us alone. I mean, we are not interested in the affairs of the state. We are interested just in our infrastructure of our life. So, for some reason, Leibovitz said that he cannot do it on his own. He cannot come up with suggestions concerning state commandments. And so he gave up the project of having state commandments having a structure, a halachic structure concerning the state, and resorted to the general attitude, which means be opposed to the danger, I mean, beware of the danger that the state becomes an idolatry. And practically, it means be constantly on the opposition. I think this was a mistake. But beware of the danger that the state might become, you know, that's the fascist view. The state is most important, is the most important entity in your vicinity. I mean, that became the only way that religious persons can express the basic values of their religion with respect to the state. I think he was mistaken because you ought to be involved. You ought to shoulder responsibility. You cannot move, you cannot change anything without being responsible. I mean, it took me a while to understand it. But from the minute I started doing ethical codes, I was already in another path, not in Leibovitch path, which is just speak against everything that moves, but okay, take responsibility. Tell people how this should work, how that should work, I did it in numerous areas of life, and I think that activities like my own changed the way people are conducting themselves, and even in a Jewish way. To some extent, in a Jewish way. I mean, people, when I wrote the first code of ethics, and I was ordered by the chief of staff to present it to commanders. So I presented 100 times to groups of commanders. And every now and then, some people ask me, what is Jewish about it? What is Jewish about it? It's a legitimate question. And my reaction was, I was just collecting feedback. I was not arguing. So what I told people is just okay. If you have some ideas of how to render it more Jewish, I'll be delighted to hear. Nobody came with any idea, except for one that is not important now, which is not really a Jewish idea at all. But what I told the people, look at it. We are the only state on earth whose military force have the following two values, which are the sanctity of human life. And what we call in Hebrew purity of arms, which means restraint of force. Restraint of force. Now think about that. Sanctity of human life. Pikuach nefesh doche hakol. The U.S. military code and the Canadian military code and Danish, you name it. I mean, they don't have sanctity of human life as a value that the soldiers constantly hear about, the preciousness of human life. And then self-restraint. I mean, what is halacha if not self-restraint? I mean, all mitzvot lo ta'aseh. I mean, there are numerous lo ta'aseh. It's self-restraint. Lo taturu achi levavchem v'achi enechem. Okay, your heart wants it. Your eyes wish for it. But don't do it. Although your eyes and heart want it. So self-restraint is very much Jewish. And there is no code of ethics that includes those two values, although we share a lot with Canada and the U.S. and U.K., all democracies, and we share basic values with them. But there is something Jewish about the values of the military. And similarly, in many other places. So there is a long historical process of forming ways of bringing the Jewish tradition closer to the state. To the affairs of the state.
We're going to be closing the conversation at this point. I want to thank Professor Kosher for being here this morning. And if you see two guys out in the hallway arguing, that'll be him and me. Thanks for coming.